KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
This is KAEB 91.9 on your FM dial. Your one-stop shop in Sandpoint from classic oldies to banging new modern.
Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there. Whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, January 13th, 2025, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebrich with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska, and my co-host is Guy Ira.
And this week, we hope you're ready to get your vitamin C, because we're talking about the tangerine darter.
And we are very pleased to welcome Casper Cox from Tennessee. He's a freshwater snorkeling enthusiast focused on the freshwaters of Appalachia. So very warm welcome to you, Casper.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here. I'm in Chattanooga, Tennessee right now, and I've snorkeled with the tangerine darters many times now.
Amazing. Well, we're excited to chat with you. And I guess to kick things off, we would love to just help people get a feel for what these fish look like. So I'm hoping you can describe what it's like coming upon a tangerine darter underwater and seeing one through your snorkel mask.
They are one of the most beautiful fish here in Tennessee. They're a darter, the Latin name for them. According to Dr. Etnier in his Fishes of Tennessee, means orange colored.
Yeah.
The Latin name Arontica starts with A-U, which is the symbol for gold. So a little bit easy there, but they're a precious fish. So gold sounds okay too, but there are a vivid tangerine orange and quite common and quite friendly to observe.
Okay. They look kind of big. I'm looking at one of Guy's pictures here, and they seem like a biggish darter. Is that true?
Yeah, they're one of the biggest darters. They come in about 6 or 7 inches. There's only one darter that's bigger than them. That's the freckled belly darter, I believe. But the tangerine is among the biggest of the darters nationwide. You know, darters are unique to North America. They're not found in other parts of the world. And I think there's over 200 different types, and there's probably 100 different ones here in landlocked Tennessee.
Do you recall the first time you ever came across a tangerine darter, either in a book or in the wild, Casper?
Well, when I first got involved with snorkeling, it was through the Tennessee Aquarium, and Dr. Etnier's and Wayne Starnes' book came out, The Fishes of Tennessee. I bought that immediately and started flipping through it, and dang, tangerine darter was very attractive in the book. And a buddy and I was out riding around looking in different waters, and I realized that we were real close to the Tellico River, and I looked over at him and he looked back at me, and I said, "Tangerine darter," and we said, "Let's go." So we drove a few more miles and ended up along the river there in Tellico Plains, Tennessee. It was a little chilly, and my buddy, he pretty much went in the water real quick, and within just a few moments, he said, "Well, there's the tangerine darter." And I said, "No, there's no way. There's not that kind of luck in the world." But he kept assuring me it was, and I finally braved up enough to get in the water, and dang, sure enough, is a whole family pod of tangerine darters right at the side of the parking lot.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, what a production.
So we know a little bit about their coloration and size. If you're looking at them, you mentioned the family pod. What other kind of behaviors do you see them doing underwater?
Well, they are like a family pod, and they kind of stick together, and there'll be juveniles and females and then some males, and the males are brightly colored on their underside, vivid tangerine orange. The females are kind of straw colored. They're not vivid like the males are. and they all share these little black dots above their lateral line, and that's a key identification marking for them.
Okay. Yeah. So when you're snorkeling with these fish, because I've been around plenty of darters, are they a little bit more friendly, or how do they respond to having a big wetsuit-wearing guy hanging out in their face?
Within a few moments, they're like puppy dogs and inquisitive and coming up to you. You can diddle your fingers in the substrate, and they'll come over to investigate if you're dislodging any kind of microorganism for them to eat, and they'll surround you. They're not afraid of you. You know, they don't flee. And the family pods are made up of a variety of sizes, juveniles and females and males interacting.
So you mentioned diddling your fingers in the substrate. I'm guessing these are pretty shallow rivers. Would you be willing to describe what it's like to just get in one of these rivers with snorkel gear and hang out with these fish?
You're only in water that's like up to your thighs, maybe your waist. There's no danger. It's not big pools. It's just quiet flowing areas below rapid and rip runs. Little quiet pools is generally where you encounter these family pods. If you want to see males in breeding condition and breeding behavior, it seems like they're more located toward fast-moving water. I mean, raging current, I've seen them at times, and so fast that it's hard to hold on.
What sort of other, talking about breeding, either interaction between males and females or males fighting, is there any sort of spawning-type behaviors that you've observed?
I've never seen them actually spawning. There's some wonderful photographs by Freshwaters Illustrated of the males riding the female and going down into the substrate, and she's released her eggs and he's releasing his sperm or milt. And that's kind of in the more quiet water. The male will follow the female around looking for, well, she's looking for prime egg-laying substrate, and he's there just waiting for her to make the move, and when she does, he mounts her. That kind of seems to be their spawning behavior. The fighting behavior is pretty fascinating. One time I was in a mountain stream and I found two advanced juvenile males, fully colored, but not yet in prime, you know, as for their age. But they were taking turns striking each other in a perpendicular fashion, like ramming each other. And one would quiver, make a target, and the other one would, boom, ram him right in the side, back and forth. And I watched them for like 10 minutes doing this, and they were oblivious to the fact that my face mask was like a foot or two from their activity.
Oh, my gosh. So
I think they were kind of practicing. If you can find some males really going at it, it'd be a battle.
Okay. What time of year is best to see them all colored up and doing some of these neat behaviors like you do this year round? Are there certain times that are better than others?
Generally depends where you're at, if you're in the valley or up in the mountains, but May is good.
Where all can you find these geographically, north to south, east to west?
Well, Dr. Etnar, he wanted to name this fish the Tennessee native fish, non-game fish for Tennessee. And very appropriately, however, it only occupies one-third of the state, the eastern third. It doesn't really go range to the central or the far western, so it would only satisfy one-third of the ichthyologist fishy people of Tennessee.
If you were to name a non-game state fish of Tennessee, which would it be, Casper?
Oh, it's hands down tangerine darter. You can ask any of your friends or ichthyologists or snorkelers, and just, I mean, it's like virtually 100% right out of their mouth, tangerine darter. The tangerine, man, it's the king.
Yeah. Are they only found in Tennessee, or are they found in any other states?
Well, the tributaries that feed the Tennessee River system can start in Georgia, like the Chickasha River. Up in Virginia, there's some tribs that come down and feed into the Tennessee River, and the same for North Carolina.
This sounds amazing, and it makes me want to get into snorkeling, and I'm curious if you could take us through how you prepare to go out for a day on the water. What's your gear? What are you thinking about? And just, yeah, how do you do it?
Well, I often try to do like 2 or 3 days together, and I can camp on a stream bank and find some places to study. And you want to know the weather, you know, you don't want to get in during a rainstorm or a recent rainstorm, kind of a quiet time, and just study the map and look for new species to encounter. It's a wonderful activity because it doesn't require hardly anything but gasoline and a map. And you can, when it's cold, like in May, you'll want to wear a wetsuit. And some people, even professionals, they'll get dry suits so they can get in the water in March and won't freeze to death. But I use a wetsuit. I like to wear a hood, too. That keeps my head warmer. Even when I'm bare skin snorkeling, I still have a hood on. Some people wear flippers, but they're just, to me, kind of dangerous, you know. It's just a good pair of shoes that you can walk on the substrate.
So what is your background professionally, Casper? Are you brought up as a fish biologist, or did you just get into this as a hobby? And how's this kind of come together in your life?
Well, I was never interested in aquariums or fish, you know, in my early years, like a lot of my friends were. But I had learned how to scuba dive, which is a lot of work, you know, getting all your gear together and driving and going out in the ocean and just, you know, and you limited amount of time and safety issues. When the Tennessee Aquarium was built here in Tennessee, they offered a snorkeling trip to the Conasauga River. And I was, what is that? What does that mean, a snorkeling trip? It got rained out twice, and I finally just asked for directions. It gave me directions. And I went there and took a friend, and I was blown away. There was so much life in that water. I mean, water is life. You're surrounded by the big fish and little fish and crawfish, and what is that? And you turn over a rock, oh my, what is that? And it's just, you're bombarded by that. And if you do it in July and August, you really don't even need a wetsuit. You can just observe the multitude of fish. But to see the colors, the spawning colors, and the spawning activity, you really want to be in there in May and a little bit into June. That's a good time.
That sounds amazing. I think a lot of people are probably missing out, not knowing that this is a thing you can go do. And I'm guessing that the fish that you're seeing probably rivals some of those marine fish that people go scuba dive to go see. But are there any other cool fish you're seeing, like really colorful ones? What else could people expect to see in some of these Tennessee rivers that you go?
Well, clear water is in our backyards. I think I've snorkeled in over half of the states in the U.S., including Alaska up there with the sticklebacks. And everywhere you go, it's new species. You cross over a mountain range and you're into a whole nother habitat. And you're constantly surprised, and it's fun to be confused and looking at it and going, what is that? I've never seen that before. And then trying to identify it and using your cameras to get as good of a picture as possible, and then consulting your friends and your books. Tennessee is just filled with all kinds of watersheds where each one is unique, and just crossing over into them and spending a few days there. It's a great hobby because it costs so little. It's fish right in our own backyard. It's just a wonderful experience. It doesn't cost hardly anything.
That's awesome.
If someone was looking to get started, besides maybe listening to this podcast episode, is there any sort of guidebook or something that someone could look into for how to get started in snorkeling, specifically in maybe Southern Appalachia?
I've written a book. It's called Snorkeling Hidden Rivers of Southern Appalachia. I'm a graphic artist by trade and a sign maker, but snorkeling is my main hobby. I was provided a grant for that from the Tennessee River Basins Network and North American Native Fishes Association, and a few other individuals. And I created this snorkel guide, and it's wire-bound, and it features 7 sites that I go snorkeling that have fairly consistently clear water. It's got the different fish you will encounter. It shows you where to go, where to eat your barbecue. So it's... It covers a lot of ground.
You mentioned Hidden Rivers in that title, and I'm curious if you could just talk to us a little bit about what that means. Is that just because people aren't familiar with them, or they're just these hidden gems, or what's the meaning behind that term I'm hearing?
Hidden Rivers probably means, you know, no one knows until they put their head in the water what is down there. I mean, it is amazing flush of life. I mean, my dad used to take me hunting when I was a boy, and you'd sit out there under a tree for a whole day with the mosquitoes biting you, and you might see a couple squirrels. But when you put your head in the water, you are surrounded by life, and it's just ever direction. And you kind of, you don't get fascinated by it, and the more places you go, the more you see, the more you learn. A lot of hobbies you get kind of, well, I've done that. Man, every time I go out, it's my body that's wearing out. I'm 67, and it's hard to do what I did in my youth. But, boy, I spend every weekend in my youth snorkeling these different rivers and watershed, ponds and lakes, oases out in Nevada with the pupfish. Man, it's just a beautiful thing. I've been up in New Hampshire in the Lamprey River with the sea lampreys and these fall fish, which is kind of like a river chub. We were up there like 2 weeks after the peak, so the mounds were kind of slightly silted over, so I didn't get to see the fall fish actually building the mounds, but I did find the wallows where the sea lampreys were wallowing it out and spawning, laying their eggs in these depressions. It's beautiful water. It's good timing. You know, weather and clarity are your biggest factors.
I want to hear a little bit more about your time up in Alaska snorkeling. I can't imagine trying to do that.
Yeah, well, it wasn't as much as I wanted. I'm kind of need a trip back. But my buddy, he was into catching the sockeye salmon. But I wanted to find places to snorkel. And we found a couple lakes, and they were real still, beautiful day. And I had blue sky everywhere, and I stripped down to my shorts. I wasn't going to fuss with a wetsuit or anything. Just brave it for a while.
Oh, it's cold, man.
Yeah, but I've built up a pretty good layer of bioprene, some people refer to it as. Yeah, I got a good circulation system and give a good few good breaths, and then I can get my blood pumping. There was one little cloud, dark cloud over there in the distance. I said, oh, that's cool. There's a blue sky everywhere. I got in there in the shallows, and I was seeing these little sticklebacks. I'm not sure, three, nine, four, spine, well, spine. I don't know what they were, but I was getting to where I was starting to observe them, and here come the rain. Oh, no, the fish don't mind when it's raining, but all my clothes were on top of my head's car. And I had to spend the rest of the day riding around in his car in nothing but a pair of shorts.
Man. Yeah, those clouds will get you up here. Sticklebacks are pretty neat. They got some fun behaviors, and they're kind of a lot of places here. But is there a place you think in every state where somebody could do this and see something cool?
Yes, I do. I think if you study your maps, if you're in the desert, yeah, there are fish in the desert. There are oases in the desert. And if you can snorkel in them, you won't see a great variety of fish, but it's a beautiful environment. Their habitat and that beauty, the plants and the substrate and the boulders, and you get to observe them. Florida, it's got all those springs to get in. The Ozarks have beautiful mountain streams that are crystal clear. We had our Nantha convention in Oklahoma this year, and a friend, Michael Wolf, and I, we spent basically 10 days going through the Ozark, the Ouachita Mountains, and snorkeling at various sites. Every state, I feel like, got springs, clear run. You just kind of study your map.
Awesome.
Do you have any, to bring this back a little bit to the tangerine darter, you mentioned taking photos and having a camera in the water. Do you have any practical advice for how to get pictures of a tangerine darter or other darter species?
Most darters are calm. Some flee when you push that camera real close to them. My camera requires my camera lens to be almost 3 or 4 inches from them. Zooming, that doesn't work. You really want to get that lens right up close to them. most of the darters are kind of friendly, and the longer you're in the water with them, the more likely they are to accept your presence. My camera's just a little pocket waterproof point shoot, but people that are really into it, man, they got gear with light racks and all kinds of stuff. I mean, I'd be scared to walk with that, you know, that you might brush it. But these little pocket cameras are great, man. They can document what you're experiencing that particular day.
Do you have a favorite memory, like the best day on the water you ever had snorkeling?
Oh, I've had so many. Man, when the light is streaming in and the water's real clear and you feel good, your sun's on your back and they're just, you know, golden bunches of fish spawning, feeding, working a riffle run. You know, it's just so many different times. You know, they're not always wonderful. I mean, you have to put yourself in that situation and you have to find that magical location. And there are days that you're not happy because you can't find what you need, or there's no trespassing signs, or cows in the water, or water's not clear. It takes a little bit of work. In my guide, though, I'm showing you like 7 sites that are virtually 90% of the time are ideal. So I've kind of done a little bit of the work for you there, but I do like to spend time just wandering with an idea of this certain region, and I'm going to explore it the best I can, and I'm often surprised when I get in there. So I don't know about the best time. There's a lot of best times. It's a beautiful experience. You're in another world when you get below the surface. There's sculpture, architecture, the stone, the life forms, the way the light is coming in and making ripple patterns on the substrate. You have truly entered another world.
Gosh, sounds lovely.
So that's a fantastic description of snorkeling. And now that we got these photos, I imagine it's easier than ever to get people out and get people in the river because they can see all these things that you're bringing back. But before you were able to carry these cameras around, what was it like trying to tell people what you saw, trying to convince them that you've got this other world available to them?
Well, if I was talking to my ichthyologist friends, they could kind of follow me. But to my regular, normal, above-the-water friends, you know, it was kind of challenging. I think when these cameras finally became available, it really added to my experience and becomes quite the challenge to get a perfect photo. And you can spend hours doing that. So then to be able to share these things without people just looking at you oddball, and I would write accounts on Facebook about my 3 days of journeying. I'll write articles for American Currents, which is NAMPA's quarterly magazine. That would be something I would recommend to anyone that's interested in snorkeling, is to go to NANFA.org, NANFA, N-A-N-F-A, North American Native Fishes Association.
I'm curious if you have any safety tips for people who are interested in entering this, I guess, recreational pursuit, whether it's anything from like sunscreen to just currents and water in general.
You know, you're supposed to have a buddy. Well, anytime you do some kind of water activity, I'm kind of on my own a lot of times, but you're generally in water that's not over your waist. I think the worst potential danger is slipping on a rock and knocking your head and being unconscious. I always leave a note on my van windshield, and I try to tell my wife where I'm going. But years ago, when I first started doing this, I wouldn't know if I was going to go right or left coming out of my driveway.
Yeah.
And there were so many opportunities. It's better to go with a friend if you have somebody available, because you can share what you're experiencing. And even though they might only be 15 yards away from you, they'll see things that you don't see. And it's nice to get out of the water and take a little break and, oh, yeah, I saw this, or be sure and look for these guys. And there's a bunch of spawning Alabama shiners in that boulder run just downstream. Safety, you know, good shoes. I got slip-resistant shoes. Now, don't step on those slippery, big, flat rocks. They're the worst.
Oh, yeah, with the algae.
Stone rollers eat all that slippery algae.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can find their little poo-poos everywhere.
We had a guy come up here, and he was doing some photography in Campbell Creek here in Anchorage, and we had to be his bear spotter. So he had his head under the water and we had someone on shore. So I think it maybe depends on your state and different safety conditions to be aware of.
We do these NAMPA conventions. And like I said, the last one was in Oklahoma. We have an annual one every year. And the next year it's going to be in Western Kentucky in an area called In Between the Lakes, I think, which is kind of a new region for me to explore. But every convention is in a different part of the country, and the host provides you a guide to explore a region you would never go to otherwise. I'm always about snorkeling, and there might only be a few of us doing it, but we make the most of our travels.
Based on what you've seen, is there anything you think people can do to help this fish?
Man and society, you know, we've learned not to dump raw chemicals in the water or sewage. There's still kind of a little bit of a problem with old septic tank cabins. But really the most damage of all, and probably the hardest to control, is siltation. Every time man disturbs the ground, and it can be for a variety of reasons. It can be for that beautiful mountain cabin you've always wanted. It could be for a new road. It could be for a farmer plowing right up next to the river instead of leaving, you know, 100-foot buffer zone of vegetation. So I think siltation, and what that does, all that silt goes down in it. Mother, it's like a wet blanket on top of the substrate. And in that formerly clean substrate, there's all kind of microorganisms in there, and that's what the tangerine darters are eating, down between the gravels, down between the pebbles, down between the rocks. But if a silt sweeps in, you know, the things can't survive.
What advice would you give to people about how to interact with this fish in the wild? Because, like, I've been snorkeling with them before. You're right. They're like puppy dogs. They come up, they nibble on my fingers when I'm in the river. And it seems like they could be easy to catch and take home. And they're a super colorful fish. I could imagine people wanting to put them in an aquarium, but that doesn't seem like that's probably the best behavior. So what would you say to people about interacting with these fish in the wild?
Yeah, when you're in the water, you know, you like a kid in the candy store. You go, oh boy, that would be so beautiful to have in my aquarium. And I could watch it anytime I want. And yeah, that's true. And there are a lot of fish that are like that. And, you know, people import them from all over the world, you know, Africa and South America. But it's really hard to replicate nature in a glass box. You can't provide the diversity of food, the cycling of the weather and the leaves coming in the water and all the microorganisms that have a part of it. But, you know, I find my satisfaction in snorkeling. I mean, it is so beautiful to be in their environment and to be a viewer of their world. I used to keep aquariums, and there are some species that do okay, but my state, we have the Tennessee, TWRA, Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency. Well, they've pretty much put the kibosh on anyone collecting live fish from a stream and taking them anywhere, home, another fishing site, anywhere. You can still stick hooks in them to catch your imported bass, but you can't leave the stream side with live fish anymore. But once again, man, I get all my satisfaction being in the water with them. It's just so beautiful.
Why should people care about these rivers and this fish?
Well, they're life. I mean, water is life. You want to swim in a nasty, garbage-laden river with trash all in it? You know, healthy streams, and you get baptized in them. You swim in them. You recreate in them. You lay in them. You get renewed in them. Clear water, man, that's the beauty. You don't go snorkeling in a nasty backwater and industrial wasteland. You want to seek out water as God intended, nature provided. I kind of hope that I'll be able to go, after I die, to go back in time and observe some of these sites as they were created before man's heavy hand had an impact. Like I said, I've snorkeled in over 25 states. You just have to seek them out. It's a great activity. It's renewing, refreshing. I always feel invigorated after I get out. You got to be tough.
Yeah.
Willing to get cold a little bit, But, you know, that first 5 minutes in the water, your body's changing. It's morphing into a better acclimating to the situation. And don't be afraid of those first 5 minutes. Just bear with it. A tangerine darter is a pinnacle of beauty within Tennessee waters. Other states have the Arkansas saddle darter, the devil's hole pupfish. Other states have beautiful fish, but Tennessee is blessed with, well, Tennessee and Alabama, they argue with each other about who has the most diversity of native fish. Tennessee's landlocked, and Alabama's got that little brackish water touch, so they got a little bit of an advantage on us.
Yeah. Didn't we get in that discussion, guy, with Bernie Kahaida?
I think we did. We were talking with Bernie about that.
Wrestle with them, but I've seen some not fist fights, but pretty much, you know, getting around the neck and squeezing out a couple more species. And nowadays, with all the DNA, scientists sometimes aren't even going out into the wild. They're just studying preserved fish and extracting DNA to say, this is a little different than what we thought was in the past. So that's a whole new species.
We got a few more minutes, Casper. Is there anything about tangerine darters or snorkeling or the importance of clean water or just any funny stories you want to share?
Well, I'm looking over my notes. I want to make sure that people go to YouTube and type in tangerine darter. There are several nice videos on YouTube. One I created years ago called Tangerine Darter Dream. There's that German instrumental electronic band called Tangerine Dream. Outstanding. And then Led Zeppelin has a song called Tangerine. And I listened to that just for the sake. And then my buddy Ed Scott has a video there that's really nice, and it's called Tangerine Darters in a Clear Stream. If people will watch those, they'll start understanding my enthusiasm.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed hearing your experiences out in the water. That was pretty cool.
Yeah. There's a world out there to experience and to explore.
Well, there's an amazing world out there to discover, so we'd love you to get out there and live with, live from, discover, and enjoy all the fish, especially the tangerine darter.
Well, come on down.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. My name is Katrina Liebeck, and my co-host is Guy Iroh. Fish of the Week is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region Office of Communications. Our production partner for the series is Citizen Race Car. We honor, thank, and celebrate the whole community, individual tribes, states, our sister agencies, fish enthusiasts, scientists, and others who have elevated our understanding and love as people and professionals of all the fish.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. A consultant hired by Anchorage's municipal attorney has nearly a dozen recommendations to improve police de-escalation and use of force policies after officers shot and killed a local teenager last year. The city just released the consultant's report to the public last week. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more.
In August, 16-year-old Easter Liafa was shot and killed by Anchorage police after they responded to a domestic disturbance at her home. Liafa had reportedly threatened one of her sisters with a knife, and she had the knife on her when officers killed her. State prosecutors later deemed the shooting was legally justified. The killing sparked outrage in Anchorage and concerns over how the police department handles use of deadly force. Shortly after Liafa's death, Mayor Suzanne LaFrance announced a series of reforms, including a third-party review of the shooting. That review was completed in November by Christopher Darcy, a former Las Vegas police officer and now consultant on law enforcement. Darcy says he can't speak to the specifics of his report for legal reasons, but broadly, he says he's found that police departments across the country often tailor how they respond to critical incidents when they arrive on the scene, and he thinks they should be more proactive.
We need to start at the very moment that the call is received. So the tactics and the training and the subsequent policies that reinforce that, and the accountability aspect, is really all focused on the actions that are starting before we arrive.
Anchorage's municipal attorney declined to release Darcy's full report, citing legal concerns, but requested he compile a separate public report citing his recommendations for training and policy changes. In the report, Darcy listed 11 recommendations, ranging from better management of high-risk responses and incorporating less lethal options into use of force training to improving interactions with both diverse communities and witnesses of police shootings. The deadline for contractors to submit bids to the city is February 13th. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
A man shot by Anchorage police last week is accused of trying to kill his former boss at a Government Hill home. 38-year-old Trevor Stefano has been charged with attempted murder, assault, and weapons misconduct in the shooting. A charging document against Stefano says he fired a shotgun at the victim's home early Wednesday. Responding officers say they saw him break windows at the home, then shoot the victim with a pistol when he stepped outside. Two officers then shot Stefano. Both Stefano and the victim, a local attorney, were critically injured and taken to a local hospital. A woman who told police Stefano gave her a ride to Government Hill that morning said she saw multiple guns in his vehicle. When they arrived, she said she saw him fire the shotgun at the home. Stefano is the second man to be shot by officers this year, a day after police shot and wounded a Midtown robbery suspect. This is Alaska Public Media.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaskans shape a brighter tomorrow since 1922. Learn more at fnbalaska.com.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Statewide News from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. The University of Alaska Fairbanks is getting $7.5 million from the U.S. Department of Energy to advance the nation's domestic supply of critical minerals. The funding was announced last week and comes after new international export restrictions for the materials. And as Shelby Herbert reports for the Alaska Desk, people involved with the project say Alaska is an especially promising location for future development.
Grant Bromhall is a science advisor for the Department of Energy, and he is overseeing a $45 million investment in critical mineral development nationwide. He says half the United States' supply of critical minerals, which are essential for many modern technology components, comes from other countries. But he says all but one of the 50 different critical minerals are found in Alaska.
You know, Alaska has incredible natural resources that we're looking to help use to support this need for cleaner, more environmentally friendly materials for our defense and national security and economic and energy security.
So $7.5 million is coming to the University of Alaska Fairbanks, one of a dozen entities across the country to get the funding. The university's Institute of Northern Engineering will use the money to expand its ongoing survey of Alaska mines and start mapping the Pacific Northwest for other critical mineral deposits.
And so this is a chance to evaluate what resources we have inside the U.S. that can be brought, particularly from secondary and unconventional sources, that can be brought in to help supply those crucial supply chains.
The grant will also help sustain UAF research on mine tailings, basically the leftover rock that piles up during mining activity. Some tailings contain bits of critical minerals that could be extracted for industrial use. Brent Sheets is directing the project on the university side. He says they're sending researchers all over the state to test samples for critical minerals. For instance, critical minerals in mine tailings at the Greens Creek mine near Juneau could be worth billions of dollars, according to UAF research. Researchers are also interested in samples from Healy's Usabelli coal mine. But Sheets says the scope of the project is so much larger than just finding out which mines have whatever materials. His lab is also trying to solve some of the huge logistical problems that stand in the way of extracting those minerals. Alaska's size and geological diversity makes it as obstacle-rich as it is opportunity-rich for mineral development. He says the state's remoteness and extreme terrain makes getting critical minerals out of Alaska difficult.
It's a little bit more than just understanding what the critical minerals are. It's what can we do to get those minerals into the marketplace? Because right now, there's no processing that goes on in the United States. That's why Department of Energy has made this a priority. So we take a look at every step in the value chain.
This year, an Australian company announced that it's trying to revive antimony mining at the Scrafford Mine near Fairbanks.
So antimony is very big right now on the list of minerals. And we're working very closely with Alaska Range Resources down in south central part of the state. But there's antimony right here in the interior, too.
Despite the challenges, Sheets says he's excited that the money will help harness Alaska's critical mineral potential at a time of such dire need, and that it'll position UAF as a central research hub in that development. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Shelby Herbert.
This is Alaska Public Media.
Think of your fellow man, lend him a helping hand, put a little love in your heart. You see, it's getting late, oh, please don't hesitate, put a little love in your heart, and the world will be a better place.
And here it is, another glorious Monday, and another Monday in paradise, of course. And hello to everybody out here in southwest Alaska. Boy, you see on the news a windstorm they had in South Central? That was a dynamite one. It was blowing 140, I think, up by a little bit east of Anchorage. That's insane. That's worse than it is here. Anyway, we'll start out with Johnny Cash with Johnny 99. After that, Dolly Parton with Single Woman. And then John Conley with I Don't Remember Loving You.
Well, they closed down the auto plant in Mahwah late last month. Ralph went out looking for a job, but he couldn't find none. He came home too drunk from mixing tangeray and wine. He got a gunshot a night clerk, now they call him Johnny 99. Down at the part of town where when you hit a red light you don't stop, Johnny's waving his gun around and threatening to blow his top. When an off-duty cop snuck up on him from behind. In front of the club, tip top, they slapped the cuffs on Johnny 99. Well, the city supplied the public defender, but the judge was Mean John Brown. He came into the courtroom and he stared poor Johnny down. Well, the evidence is clear, gonna let the sentence fit the crime. 98 in a year, we'll make it even, Johnny 99. Out in the courtroom, they had to drag Johnny's girl away. His mama stood up and shouted, "Judge, don't take my boy this way." Well, son, you got any statements you'd like to make before the bailiff comes to forever take you away? Yes, Judge, I've got debts no honest man could pay. The bank was holding my mortgage, they was taking my house away. Now I ain't saying that makes me an innocent man, but it was more than all this that put that gun in my hand. And Your Honor, I do believe I'd be better off dead. Take a man's life for the thoughts that are in his head. Then won't you sit back in that chair and think it over one more time? Then let them shave off my head and burn Johnny 99.
lots of friends to share the laughter, not a one to share the tears. And you wish that change that jukebox, 'cause you know every song they play. Can I drop you off in my place? Oh, what's the matter? Are you gay? You got a 20 in your pocket, but your toothbrush in your purse. To make it till the morning, looking for what they can find.
I don't remember loving you, and I don't recall the things you say you put me through. You tell me that you've had a guilty conscience for so long. You say that you walked out on me. You say you did me wrong. Well, I just don't see how that could be true, 'cause I don't remember loving you. I don't remember loving you. You might talk to my doctor, he drops by each day or two. I get a funny feeling when I look into your eyes. There's something in your smile that gives my stomach butterflies. You must look like someone I once knew, but I don't remember loving you. Children, did you say there's one or two? You say I quit my job and then I drank myself insane. You say that I ran down the highway screaming out your name. Now that's not the sort of thing that I would do. No, I don't remember loving you. I don't remember loving you. I absolutely, positively know that can't be true. But everyone I know here in this place is very strange. If you'll hand me my crayons, I'll be glad to take your name. In case I run across the guy you knew, but I don't remember loving you. I don't remember loving you. And I don't recall the things you say you put me through. You tell me that you've had a guilty conscience for so long. You say that you walked out on me. You say you did me wrong. Well, I just don't see how that could be true, 'cause I don't remember loving you. I don't remember loving you. And I don't recall the things you say you put me through. You tell me that you've had a guilty conscience for so long. You say that you walked out.
And take us to the top of the hour, we have Porter Wagoner with Comes and Goes, and then Conway Twitty after that with The Clown. And let me see. I think that'll do it here. Yeah, we got 6 minutes left.
Now and then, here and there, I still see her. Sometimes my memory lets me hear her voice so soft and low. But like the wind she travels in, she seems to come and go. At times my mind seems crystal clear, and then I think of her. Then the spin of the room I'm in is nothing but a blur. A love that once held my mind completely in control now makes it spin like tornado winds as it comes and goes. Well, look who's here. I told myself that you'd be coming soon. I hope that you can stay for a while. I'm so lonesome in this room. You look so beautiful today. Do you still love me so? What's that you say? You can't stay. You seem to come and go. At times my mind seems crystal clear, and then I think of her. Then the spin of the room I'm in is nothing but a blur. A love that once held my mind completely in control now makes it spin like tornado winds as it comes and goes. Catch my breath, like walking on a high wire. Lord, it scares me half to death. You're always high above me, and I'm always falling down. Our love's just a circus, baby. I'm just the clown. And I'll do tricks for you, just like you want me to. Smile for you to cover up my frown. 'Cause our love's a circus, and I'm just the clown. Just look at me and laugh, and I'll
they'll bet when they see me cry. They think it's just an act. Ah, but someday when it's over, and we bring the big top down, can say it was one big circus, and I was just the clown. And I'll do tricks for you, just like you want.